Welcome to Them Before Us on American Family Radio, where we strive to put children before adults. Our goal is to educate the public on a child-centric perspective of marriage and family and represent the rights of children on policy matters. Now, here's the host and founder of Them Before Us, Katie Faust.
Happy weekend to you and welcome to Them Before Us Radio. I'm your host, Katie Faust. I'm joined this morning with my engagement director, Patience, and we are going to cover some of the child-centric trending news that is taking place this week. And before we do that, though, I want to start us off with a little bit of Bible time. I've been going through Exodus on my own, but my youngest son and I are reading through Philippians, and I just feel like every verse you could just stop and have a discussion about. So that's what we did yesterday when we read Philippians chapter 2, this passage that is really one of my favorite, probably because it so crystallizes exactly what it is that Christians need to be about today. It positions us accurately in the midst of a culture that rejects nearly everything about God's design, God's ordained laws, and a society that reflects his character about mercy and justice. So this passage, starting in verse 14, says, "Do everything without grumbling or arguing." And my son and I spent quite a bit of time talking about that. "So that you may become blameless and pure." God wants us to stand out. He wants us to look different. He wants us to be blameless and pure. "Children of God without fault in a crooked and perverse generation." Crooked and perverse generation. How could you possibly capture the state of American society today in more concise language than we are living in a crooked and perverse generation? We're going to talk a little bit about some of the manifestations of that crookedness in our trending news. But then he says, why he wants us to be faultless, pure, blameless, because then you will shine like stars in the sky as you hold firmly to the word of life. He wants us to be that city on a hill. He wants us to be light in the darkness. And right now, there is a lot of darkness around us. So we have to be diligent to turn ourselves inward, fully examine, are we faultless? Are we pure? Are we blameless? Because God actually has work for us to do, and it is to hold out the word of life so that people can see the darkness around them, the darkness they're participating in, and reject it. So we're going to turn to some trending news now. And the first one is really the heart of darkness, I would say, the porn industry. And, you know, as we've talked about before on this show, pornography is and always has been around, but pornography has morphed dramatically with the rise of the internet. You know, when I was a kid, you'd have to go into like a shady video store with blacked out windows and show an ID if you wanted to rent a bad movie. Or you'd have to like have ID to get, you know, the Penthouse magazine or the Hustler magazine that was always like covered at the back of the bookstore. No longer. Now porn has utterly transformed because it is completely accessible via the internet, completely free in many cases, and anonymous. Nobody sees you going out of the bookstore. And that has given rise to rampant pornography use and production. And that is harming kids. And so that's what we want to talk about this morning. Patience has been incredibly involved in an amicus brief that Them Before Us filed in a critical case coming out of Texas. So first, Patience, can you just tell us what's going on in Texas and what this case is about?
Yeah, absolutely. So Texas is one of a number of states that passed a law requiring age verification on pornography websites. So in order to access the website, you have to actually prove that you're an adult rather than just clicking a little box and saying, yep, I am the age that you're requiring for this. So a group of pornography websites, pornography producers calling themselves the Free Speech Coalition, challenged this law in Texas, saying, hey, this is a an affront to our free speech, and this is unconstitutional. So it's going to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court is going to consider whether or not there is a constitutional right for these websites to be making their content available to all users, and whether or not this law that protects minors from this content is going to uphold to constitutional muster.
Yeah, perfect. So if you've read our third book, Pro-Child Politics, we have an entire chapter on pornography and why this is actually not about free speech, even though for a while we have thought about it that way, or at least it's been characterized like that in a couple different court cases that have come before the different justices and the different appellate courts. And we are now at the place where we are making the case. This has nothing to do with speech. So we at Them Before Us submitted an amicus brief with, it just means a friend of the court brief, something that we think would be helpful for the justices to consider as they adjudicate in this case. And as always, our brief talks about why these age verification laws are actually a matter of child protection, that children are significantly harmed when they are exposed to pornographic content. So from here on out, we're going to be discussing our brief. And our brief discusses some pretty graphic aspects of pornography. So if you've got some little ones in your orbit, you might want to pause this. You might want to put your AirPods in. The next 5 minutes or so might not be something that you want them to hear, which drives home the fact that it is not something you want them to see. So patients, can you just describe what our brief aims at and what our goal was in submitting this to the court?
Yeah, so we worked with a former FBI agent to help us compile this brief. And what we're doing is we're making it very clear to the court that these websites are hosting content that is horribly harmful to children. So we're very candid with the court about what's being posted on these websites. At one point in the brief, we walk them through, hey, here's what a child would find on the homepage of one of the most popular pornographic websites. And it's pretty horrifying what they would find. You do not have to go digging on these websites to find violent content, to find content that is fantasizing about incest, to find content that shows what appears to be gang rape. And this is what a child would come across just by navigating from the homepage. They would not have to type in and search something. They would just need to click through what's being offered when you immediately load that website, which is really horrifying, especially considering that the average age of first exposure to pornography is 12 years old. And since it's the average, that means there it's younger than 12 accessing these websites and being exposed to this content.
I think one clarification that needs to be made is when a lot of us, you know, I'm a Gen Xer, or if you're like older than me, you think about pornography in terms of Playboy, like nude pictures of women or women in like skimpy bathing suits. That is not what porn is on the internet. I mean, what we describe in our brief, we just list the titles of some of the most popular videos. And you have to bleep out the titles for the sake of going before the court in a lot of these different cases. We tried to share a screenshot of the homepage of porn, of, you know, one of the largest porn producers in the world that is, you know, obviously upset that this Texas law came down. And you could not even show, there was no images that we could even, we had to black out everything on the homepage where there's no screening. Any child can just accidentally or purposefully search these websites and find incredibly disturbing content. Like patients said, like a vast, you know, I saw one study that showed that 85% of pornographic videos on a certain website included violence against women. So it's no surprise that children who stumble upon this at first, but then become addicted to it, are going to carry those violent behaviors into their relationships. And so we talk about the disturbing trend of things like choking during sex, that young teenagers now believe that choking is kind of goes hand in hand with having sex, because porn is functioning as sex education for so many kids, but they're not exposing children to real sex. They're not exposing children to the mutual self-giving of husband and wife in a way that is respectful and generous and consensual by both parties. It is violent. It is graphic. It is demented. There's categories of porn that, weave in cartoons and, like Patience said, like incest and a lot of horribly abusive content. We need to protect kids from this incredible assault on their innocence that has very real implications for their development. Patience, what are we hoping we are going to achieve by submitting this brief?
Well, we're hoping that the Supreme Court will look at this brief and will see the reality of this industry and see that this is not about free speech. This is about protecting children from extremely disturbing content, like you said. And one of the things that we've seen and we highlight in this brief is that the first generation to grow up with access to internet pornography has a terribly distorted view of sex right now. There was a study from last year that we quote in our brief that found a third of college women report having been strangled in their most recent sexual encounter. So this is not just a one-time bad experience, but this is what is normal for young adults today. And also, most likely a lot of these sexual encounters are, outside of marriage and normalizing, just the hookup culture that is rampant on college campuses.
So Patience, I want to clarify something that you said because it surprised me when I read it. Mm-hmm. Say that statistic again. 30% of college women what?
Were strangled in their most recent sexual encounter.
Okay, so just to
clarify. And by strangulation, this study is talking about like actual beginning phases of asphyxiation. You're not getting enough oxygen to your brain, which causes sometimes permanent damage.
This was not 30% of college women who had ever been strangled. Mm-hmm. It was their last sexual encounter had strangulation, which will tell you that this is probably a repeat occurrence for many of them. And that some of them who didn't report it in their last sexual encounter might've had it previously. I think that it's very hard for people who did not grow up with the internet to understand how horribly destructive pornography is on the minds of young people, right? And I tell my kids, you may not be looking for porn, but porn is looking for you. It is very, very important to protect children from an industry that wants to hook them and make them lifelong consumers. That is why the industry fights against these age verification laws, because if they capture a 50-year-old guy, well, they've got a customer for 20 or 30 years. But if they get a 10-year-old, they have a customer for life, for 70 or 80 years. We have got to put safeguards in place. And obviously, parents play a huge role in that. We need to make sure that we have devices on our internet that is going to block harmful content. We need to monitor their use of screens. We need to delay the introduction of screens in their life. Children should not have access, unrestricted access to the internet, until their teen years. And in my opinion, that is after you have trained them to identify harmful content and reject it. So this is an aspect for sure of parental training and monitoring. But as we talk about in our pornography chapter of pro-child politics, it should not be something that parents have to do alone. We have other measures to protect children from harmful online content. This is, the gaming industry. If you want to place bets on the presidential election or a sports team, you've got to submit age verification. And I'll tell you what, betting on the Lakers is not as harmful to kids as stumbling upon even one of these videos that we mentioned in our brief. So this is absolutely a matter of child protection. I urge you to go get Pro-Child Politics, read the pornography chapter. We go in depth in terms of why pornography harms kids and exactly what we should be doing as a government to protect children from this scourge that very often has lifelong implications for them and the people that they are in relationships with. Stay with us. We're going to come back and we're going to talk about a major case that was heard at the Supreme Court this week. We'll be right back with you.
Welcome back to Them Before Us on American Family Radio.
I'm your host, Katie Faust. I am joined with Them Before Us Engagement Director Patience Sunny, and we're breaking down some of the major news that has taken place over the last week. And one thing that we have to highlight is this huge case that was heard at the Supreme Court on Thursday regarding whether or not you can ban transgender treatments for children. So, Patience, tell us exactly what it is that the court is going to be looking at and deciding.
Yeah, so the Supreme Court's going to be looking at a law that came out of Tennessee that bans gender transition for minors. And this, you know, caused waves among progressives. They don't want to see those transitions being banned. And so this is a case challenging that law. And in recent years, there have been many reports, whistleblowers, etc., revealing just the horrifying reality of these procedures. And actually, this Tennessee law was in response to a report about what was going on at a Tennessee hospital where kids were being transitioned and the very cavalier attitudes of the people who are rushing children into these harmful so-called medical procedures that cause irreversible damage to their bodies.
Yeah, I was just listening to an interview by Chloe Cole, who's probably one of the most well-known detransitioners, and she was at the court on, at the Supreme Court steps to talk about the importance of the case. You know, she is somebody who, a girl who, like many girls, when they are going through puberty, their tomboyishness manifested as a lot of discomfort with her female body, and she was put on Lupron puberty blockers. And that is a drug that is off-label for children, typically is used to treat prostate cancer in men and chemically castrate sex offenders. And she was put on it at the age of 13, and then she was given a double mastectomy. She had her perfectly healthy breasts removed at the age of 15. And of course, much of this was due to the doctors themselves, the doctors who said to her parents, you must allow her to transition from being a girl to being a boy, otherwise she will kill herself. So there was all kinds of coercion and emotional manipulation directed at her parents. And it wasn't maybe a year after she had that surgery where she said, wait a second, I actually am comfortable being a woman. I want to be a mom. I want to be able to breastfeed my children. But now I've done these irreversible procedures to my body and I regret it. And so what this law aims at is not necessarily banning transgender treatments for adults, but putting an absolute stop to transing the kids. Because they cannot consent to this. They actually don't have the capacity to say, I understand the medical risks of going through this chemical or surgical transition or treatment. And B, it's, we don't actually know a lot of the fallout and the harms of some of these procedures. So patients, tell us a little bit about like what it is that is really being challenged at the court. Like what is it that is going to be decided and what's at stake here?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, this is a case that's, it's going to have implications for many states because we've seen a growing number of states moving to pass these bans on gender transition for minors, recognizing the horrible harm that's being done to kids and saying, no, we are not going to do this. So what's at stake is really the future of the next generation. Will they be subjected to these so-called gender transitions, or will their bodies be protected when they're struggling with this very real mental health concern? Like you said, with the Chloe Cole case, the coercion from doctors on this issue is really troubling because the best research shows that gender transition actually does not help the mental health of the kids who are struggling with this. There's been analysis looking at these studies that claim to show that if you don't transition your kids, they're going to commit suicide. And actually, they show that depression worsens after gender transition, which is not at all surprising. Kids have been rushed into doing something that is damaging to their bodies. We don't understand the full effect. We don't understand the full long-term consequences because this is medical experimentation that's being done on children. And what's particularly striking is that Europe has already begun shifting away from this. And this is really just the United States following Europe's example. After
Yeah, we're not the only, Tennessee is not the only state that's trying to figure out how to deal with this. We have seen a reversal in the UK and all across Europe. Some of the countries that were early adopters of these radical transition treatments for kids have completely backed away because they've looked at the evidence and they've said, this doesn't help kids. You know, there's about two-thirds of children who are diagnosed with gender dysphoria or kind of rushed into the pipeline of transgender treatments have other psychological problems, other underlying issues like depression or anxiety, traumatic experiences, dissociative disorders. And so it's no wonder that they continue to struggle after they have been quote unquote transitioned, because the transition does not fix the underlying diagnosis. It does not make the depression or the anxiety go away. Sometimes the kids experience some temporary relief because they feel like they are escaping. A lot of times there has been sexual trauma, or there has been, there are some other body dysmorphic issues, or a rejection, for example, of a child's femininity because they were assaulted. They think, if I wasn't a woman, therefore I am going to be protected against the kind of assault that I experienced. And so sometimes there is temporary relief after they start the puberty blockers, or maybe after the surgery is complete. But very soon after, they realize, actually, I still have the same problems as before, but now I have a body that doesn't function. Now I am going to be a lifelong consumer of this hormone treatment because I've removed the parts of my body that will create that hormone on its own. And it's horrifying. And I know that some of the whistleblowers that came forward to talk about the harms of these treatments given to children did talk about the financial connection here. If you're able to transition a child like Chloe Cole starting at age 13, you know what you get? You get a lifelong patient. These people, whether they detransition or remain as their, you know, sort of cosplaying as the opposite sex, they will need help from pharmaceutical companies for the rest of their life. And very often, the surgeries that are performed to create a more masculine or feminine appearance are not one-time surgeries. Many of them need maintenance. And so if you're able to, I mean, honestly, it is predatory like the porn industry. If you can get them young, you get them for life. And we need to protect kids against both. So any other final thoughts on this patient's, you know, what you are hoping to see, what you think would be the best outcome for a case like this?
I mean, the best outcome would be for the court to say that children need to be protected from these procedures. And one of the things that's particularly striking in the argumentation around this case is this insistence that this is actually about parental rights from members on the left. And it kind of this misunderstanding of what parental rights means, because really what this comes down to is it is abusive to experiment on children in this way. And nobody who supports parental rights say that parents have a right to abuse their children, have a right to subject their children to mistreatment.
Yeah, that's exactly right. At Them Before Us, we talk a lot about how actually, if you look at everything from the perspective of child rights, you get all of this exactly right. And parents don't have a right to expose their children to graphic content. They don't have a right to abuse their children. They don't have a right to poison their children, which honestly is what these puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones do. So parental rights does not mean I can do whatever I want with this kid. Parental rights means you have an obligation and a duty to raise, love, and protect your child. And right now, the abortion industry, the big fertility industry, the pornography industry, and the transgender industry are all industries that parents need to protect their children from. We're going to talk about another story that was covered by World Magazine. And it's this idea that some emergency rooms are not equipped to actually handle child emergencies. So what is it that the World Magazine uncovered when it came to whether or not the ER is going to be able to handle your child's broken arm or their possible appendicitis or maybe your infant's, you know, diagnosing your infant's fever? Like, what is it that World Magazine uncovered?
Yeah, so World Magazine reported on a new study published by Health Affairs that shows pediatric care in hospital emergency rooms is consistently inconsistent and unreliable A lot of these emergency rooms are woefully under-equipped to deal with children's medical emergencies. And they cite some research from Wall Street Journal in 2023 that noted only 14% of emergency departments are prepared for child emergencies, which is really quite shocking. You know, generally, if you bring your child to the emergency room, you expect that they're going to be well-equipped to handle that. But the reality is that most of them are not. Children aren't able to articulate their symptoms as well as adults. Their bodies and needs are uniquely different from adults because they're still growing. Their airways are smaller. Their body temperature fluctuates more than adults. They metabolize differently. And so what's really needed is for emergency rooms to be prepared for the specifics of taking care of a child, as opposed to taking care of an adult. And many of them are not.
Yeah, you really do have to have, as a doctor, right, that very specific experience and lens when dealing with kids. I remember our oldest, our first child, I was kind of playing with her on the couch, like holding her arms and like dropping her down between my legs and then pulling her back up with this sort of little song game. And then she started holding her arm. And I was like, oh my gosh, like what happened? Like there was no, it wasn't like a really rough play or anything. But as the day went on, like she wouldn't move her arm at all. And I was like, oh my gosh, what's happening here? So we took her to the emergency room. And oh my goodness, they took x-rays, but it meant like pulling her arm out and manipulating her arm. And she was, I'd never, ever heard her wail like that. And I just thought, oh, what is going on here? And we were there for a couple hours while they were like pulling and manipulating and prodding. And finally, they did get an ER doctor in there who said, oh, this is a dislocated elbow. It happens with kids all the time because their ligaments aren't as strong. And then he very quickly relocated it, which was painful, but 5 seconds long. But it really was a case of the people in the emergency room did not know enough about kids to diagnose the situation accurately, because it is pretty common in young kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and a November study estimated that it would actually be pretty inexpensive to equip these emergency rooms to deal with child emergencies. They estimated it from it to be around $12 per child is really what it would take to do this. And so, you know, looking back at the transgender case, it's really disappointing that we have hospitals that are expanding to offer gender clinics when their ERs are not equipped to handle child emergencies, which is a much more pressing need and actually would be taking care of these children.
Yeah. When you look at the Hippocratic Oath of do no harm, there is a very clear distinction between experimental treatments that already we know create lifelong harm, irreversible damage to children's young bodies, and an emergency room that is there to heal the child, that is there to really facilitate, the aiding them in an emergency, which, you know, I don't spend a lot of time in the ER, thank God, with my kids. But the times that I have, I'm like, I desperately need somebody who knows what they are doing because my kid just got like stuck in the eye with a stick. And are they going to go blind? And I really needed somebody to, you know, give me that targeted, immediate help. And so it's amazing to me that they don't seem to be spending the resources on these very clear-cut emergency needs. But we do know that major hospitals across the country, I know my children's hospital in Washington State is one of the chief offenders when it comes to pouring tons of resources into these gender clinics and gender treatments.
Yeah. Another thing to consider with the ER issue is, you know, a lot of hospitals, even though it would be relatively inexpensive, they don't see it as that important because they're not seeing as many child emergencies as they used to. So, you know, just anecdotally, several years ago, my younger sister broke her arm falling off the monkey bars. And when my parents brought her in, the ER doctor said, you know, we don't see cases like this anymore because kids aren't playing outside. And so they're not receiving these injuries. And, you know, that's not to say kids should be receiving injuries. But because kids aren't playing outside as much, there just isn't, hospitals don't see it as a pressing need. And what was really striking was the ER doctor said that what he sees instead is mental health emergencies from these kids, which, you know, that takes a completely different set of specialization to deal with. And it's really tragic that instead of, you know, a child's bell while playing, and, you know, can get bandaged up and taken care of quickly. Instead, it's a child is spiraling into despair because they're not interacting with the outside world and they're just locked into their screens.
Yeah, I actually remember seeing that those statistics about the decline in childhood injuries. And you look at that and you're like, oh, fantastic. No, not fantastic. Kids are not riding bikes. They're not climbing trees. They're not playing on the monkey bars. They're not running around the neighborhood. You know, they're not digging ditches, which my kids, you know, there was a few ditch digging like seasons of their life, for example, like they just loved like digging and filling in and all of that. And it's true that, like, fine, your kids aren't getting injured, but they're also not having a childhood. You know, Maria Baer in the Pro-Child Politics chapter on digital technology talks about how a real childhood has to be embodied. It cannot be on a screen. And we actually short-circuit our humanity when so much of the critical learning for kids takes place online and on screens. And then obviously there's a correlation between that and, you know, tenuous mental health in these kids. So we as parents need to be very, very aware, obviously, of who our children are and what they need. That does mean a lot of outside play. It does mean monitoring them. But, you know, sometimes that results in a dislocated elbow or a stick to the eye, which he's fully recovered, FYI, wasn't a major issue. But, you know, there is some risk involved in an embodied childhood. But the alternative is a short-circuited humanity. And so I think about this and I'm like, which is going first? Like, is it, you know, are emergency rooms not dealing with this because they don't have enough kids to treat? Or is it an anti-child mentality that is driving them towards other priorities? Thanks for being with us. We're going to be right back with your questions and our answers.
If you'd like to comment on the show, email comments@thembeforeus.com. Once again, here's Katie Faust.
Welcome back to Them Before Us Radio. I'm your host, Katie Faust, founder and president of the children's rights nonprofit Them Before Us, which works to center the child in all conversations about marriage and family. We do a lot of advocacy. We do a lot of policy work. We have resources for churches. We have resources for corporations. We've got books that are going to help you prioritize kids, whether that is in conversations about marriage and family, whether it is thinking about all of politics through the lens of putting kids first, or when it comes to raising your own children to be strong and to reject the lies of this culture so that they can grow up to be responsible citizens who love God and their neighbor. And we talk aspirationally about the importance of prioritizing children above adult desires and specifically defending their rights, their right to life, their right to their mother and father, the right to innocence from things like rampant distorted pornography, and the right to an intact unmedicalized body from things like transgender treatments. But we also need to understand how to live this out in our daily life, in our own relationships, and in our own parenting. So that's what we try to do in the final segment of Them Before Us Radio, is answer the questions that you have about putting kids first. And to help me with that, I've got Jen Friesen here, the training director for Them Before Us, the one that is in charge of and spearheads our video curriculum for small groups. And so you should, if you're in church and you think that this content would be helpful to your congregation, come to Them Before Us, go to the menu tab, look at resources for churches, click on it. It's totally free. And then reach out to Jen if it's something that you want to employ in your context, in your neighborhood, in your community. But Jen also runs our social media. She is the person that produces our podcast. She's got her finger on the pulse of Them Before Us followers. And she has some questions from you that we're going to answer this week.
Hey, Katie. Hey, everybody. Glad to be here again. And thanks for the plug for the small group curriculum. We're excited about it. People are enjoying it. So yeah, definitely go check that out. All right, question number one, considering you're raising conservative kids in a woke city book, these folks would like to know, do you or did you make your kids go to church? We're debating that, whether or not they should do it. And if it's okay to miss Sundays for things like sports, et cetera, they're maybe wondering, are we going to screw our kids up if we make them go? Are we going to screw them up if we let them miss it for different things?
We made our kids go to church, especially in the elementary school years. And the good news is that church was a delight. I mean, it's not like we always loved the music. I mean, my husband was the pastor, but there's things about church that weren't perfect, but I will tell you, they were so well loved by the congregation. And the, even though the, you know, we didn't have a lot of glitzy, like jazz hands, look at this shiny, like curriculum. They just had the truth in age appropriate ways by people that loved them, whether it was children's church or Sunday school or youth group. They've always had a very positive association with church, even if it didn't have like bells and whistles and frills. So by the time the kids, so yes, we had a premium on getting the kids to church. We were always doing it together. We always sat in the same pew, you know, up front. And I will tell you the other thing about church is it wasn't just like, we're going to come and we're going to learn about Jesus and we're going to worship. It was maximum like physical connection time for us too. So like, when the kids were really little, they would lay their head in my lap and I would scratch their back. Or if they were trying to like pay attention and, you know, they later would bring like journals and they would draw, like they would perfect their drawing while they listened to the sermon. All of my kids know how to make paper cranes because we would constantly be taking the programs and turning them into paper cranes. So they have a real positive association, you know, with just connecting with mom. We would even do something where, you know, if they were really antsy and itchy, I would take a word, like a theme from the sermon, and I would spell it out letter by letter on their back. And so like, it was a time, not just of loving God, but like sweetness between our family. And then as the kids grew, you know, and started to, you know, the boys got taller than me, they would still grab me around the waist or around the neck and pull me close when they were singing. And so like those elementary school years build in, not just we go to church, but I love church and there's a sweetness to church. When it comes to exceptions, we totally make exceptions. Like, we try not to be militant about that, especially when the kids get to be middle school and high school. Our parenting philosophy is we really lean out. We give our kids a lot of autonomy over their own choices and their own lives. We totally prioritize church. But there were times when, you know, our second daughter was on a very competitive soccer team and they would be gone for the weekend, or maybe she would have a game that was on Sunday. We skipped a lot of those games when she was early on in her soccer career. But, you know, then you get to the point where you're on a travel team and she did miss some days at church, but she didn't miss her morning Bible time. And she didn't miss her own personal devotion time. And she was still finding those times to connect with God. So we do relax quite a bit in middle school and in high school, especially in high school. And I mean, we're not all the way through this parenting journey. We've got two girls in college. We've got two in high school. Right now, they're all pretty committed to church, you know, wherever they are.
That's great. I've heard some parenting advice that says, you know, more in the high school years, you kind of transition to more of a coach. You're a little more on the sidelines. You're a little more intersecting with when they're asking you for help. But I also am kind of in the, when you're under my house, you're under our rules. There's a little more of that when they still live with you and are dependent on you in that way. But also to your point, when church is sweet and when it's fun, we never thought going to church because we had so many friends there. It was just enjoyable and I liked being there. So I think, you know, you can make church a sweet experience where it's not that kids are being forced to go against their will, because that's a whole different challenge. But all right, next question. What is the best way to stay informed about politics and the world without being overwhelmed with everything bad that's happening? I know you have to be pretty engaged with things going on. So yeah, how do you balance that with not being just utterly depressed?
Yeah, I'm an information junkie. I actually have like thought about this. I'm like, is this a problem? Like, I feel like I can't get enough information. So I tend to not get overwhelmed, or if there is something challenging or distressing happening in the world, I'm like, tell me more about that. Let me find more interviews and people that can look at this from other angles. Like, how can I become an expert on whatever is transpiring, you know, the ceasefire, you know, in Israel, and like the different players, or like what actually is going on with RFK taking the lead at Health and Human Services, like what's his position on? I mean, so it's just all kinds of news where I look at this and I'm like, oh, that could be concerning. Give me more. So the way that I do it personally is I listen to a variety of podcasts, people from different perspectives, but who are fair And I love interviews. I love hearing different perspectives of people who maybe I don't necessarily agree with on everything, but is going to give me a more well-rounded opinion. And I find that a good interview, even if it's challenging or depressing information, is edifying. For me, just getting good information is, I mean, I hate the word empowering, but it is empowering. You know, it's like, I don't feel like I'm going to be blindsided or taken out by, one whiff of bad news, because you already have built sort of a stable foundation to understand and contextualize whatever it is that's coming across your newsfeed. So I also think that that's a great recipe for transmitting your worldview to your kids. You know, we talk about it in our second book that I co-authored with Stacey Manning, Raising Conservative Kids, that if you're listening to great podcasts and you're reading great articles and you're watching great interviews, just include your kids in that. Like if it's on the speaker while you're cooking dinner, great. If, you know, my kids would walk into the house and if I was listening to a great podcast, I would just pop an AirPod in their ear. And then as long as they were in the same room as me, they were hearing what I was hearing. So I just find that, you know, tuning into great sources and then including your kids in those great sources is the way to sort of balance the, I need information, but I also don't want to be overwhelmed.
I think too, it's kind of the balance of, does it need to be 24/7 the news cycle, or can you incorporate, I'm listening to an audiobook, I'm listening to some music I enjoy, you know, that it doesn't have to be like from sun up to sundown listening to the bad stuff happening in the world. There's also a lot of, I like looking up like good news, you know, Twitter, like the good news stuff that happens, like, oh, okay, there's just good things happening too that I can also engage with or repost or whatever. So, yeah. All right, final question. When you talk about children's rights, isn't that elevating kids above what their parents might determine is best for them? I had this conversation with someone. It was saying kind of, you know, are children's rights more important than parental rights? We kind of compare, we define what rights are and then we compare it to adult desires. So can you help make that distinction?
Yeah. And it's a really important question because obviously it looks like there are competing rights in some ways. You know, we talked about earlier on in the show about how some people that are opposing the laws that would cease the transition of children in the name of like gender medicine. Some of the opponents of that are people that are like, well, isn't this a parental rights issue? And parents have a right to transition their child. Parents have a right to choose to put them on puberty blockers. Parents have a right to allow them to have their breasts removed. And so do parents have that right? So all of this really comes down to properly understanding what we mean by rights. In our first book, Them Before Us, Why We Need a Global Children's Rights Movement, we talk about what it is, what's a natural right? How do we know what a right is? And unfortunately today, anything that somebody really, 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 really wants is framed as a right. Sometimes even things that we might need are framed as a right. But just because you want it, and even if you might need it, it is not necessarily a natural right. So understanding what a natural right is critical to answering this question. Are children's rights in competition with adult rights? Or are children's rights simply anything that a child wants, they have a right to? So what is it like? How do you determine what actually is a right? And Stacey Manning and I, as we were writing that chapter, you know, we're not natural lawyers, but we did have the book. The foreword was written by one of the preeminent natural law scholars, Robert George. So we're not looking at this from a, like we're absolute masters of natural law, but we kind of boiled down like sort of a rubric to understand what is and isn't a natural right. So we have a three rules that make it a right test. The first one is a real natural right existed pre-government. It's not something that the government gives you. It's not something the government grants you. It's something that existed before the government was established. Think about your right to life. Government didn't give you that. You had it pre-government. Before the United States was set up, you know, or before the Egyptian pharaoh took, you know, sat down on his throne, people had life. It existed before the establishment of government. It's the same thing with children's rights to their parents. Like it existed pre-government, whether you are sort of looking at it from an evolutionary perspective or a biological perspective, this right that we have to the two people responsible for our existence, this relationship existed pre-government. So number one, government doesn't give it to you. You had it before the government was established. Number two, nobody has to provide it for you. So if it has to be dug up from the ground and plumbed into your house or put into a bottle and labeled and put on a shelf at your grocery store, it's not a right. If somebody has to go through 12 years of medical school, you don't have a right to their medical services. A real natural right doesn't have to be provided to you. You simply have it, like a right to self-defense or a right to free speech. So it's not something that someone gives to you. It is something that the government exists actually to protect. And then another way that you know that something is a natural right is it's distributed equally. Everybody gets the same amount. So I guarantee you, listener, you have the same amount of life as I do. And that's exactly one. You have the same number of parents as I do. Two, you have a mother and a father. Even if you didn't know them, even if you lost them, even if one of them died, you did not exist without those two people coming together to create you. So we can look at these things and see, actually, children have a natural right to their parents, and parents have a natural right to their children. Now that's it. That's the rights language, okay? It does not mean that kids get whatever they want. If they want that extra candy bar, you have to give them the extra candy bar. And it certainly doesn't mean that parents who want to expose their children to pornography get to expose their children to pornography. You don't have a right to expose your children to destructive content. Children don't have a right to be little emperors or little empresses in their home demanding that their parents bow to their every wishes. There are fundamental rights that both parents and children have. And when you properly define rights, what you see is true parental rights and true children's rights perfectly reinforce one another. I haven't left you much time, Jen, but do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I agree with everything you're saying. It's really just defining those terms, right? Because we can't compare what kids want to do with what adults want to do. We can't compare natural children's rights with natural adult rights. We're comparing natural rights of children to the things adults want to do. So I think defining those terms is always really important. And I've started saying children's natural rights, and then because it kind of just helps get a little bit more of what I'm talking about than the way people are traditionally using it.
Yep. So culturally, we get this wrong by thinking that our wants are rights, whether they're children's wants or adult wants. And some of our civil laws get this wrong too. You know, Martin Luther King Jr. Argued for the full natural rights of blacks, even though it wasn't recognized in civil law. So that's sort of our legacy. We are here to defend children's rights, regardless of what the culture says, and sometimes even if the law gets things wrong. We are here to protect children, their fundamental rights. And when we protect their fundamental rights, we secure thriving for our entire nation. Thanks for joining us, and we will chat next week.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.